I received my undergraduate degree from Penn State. Do we have any Nittany Lions in the house? Oh man, not even one? All right, we're far away. It was really a great college experience for me. Besides all the fun things I got to study, as a student, I got to get season tickets for Penn State football. So I basically went to every single home game from 1997 through 2001, something like 30 football games. I can remember hard-fought victories and crushing defeats. But despite my personal experience, the vast majority of these wins and losses were struck from the record in 2012, like the games had never been played. This happened because in 2011, a scandal was revealed. Jerry Sandusky, an assistant coach for Penn State football, was indicted and ultimately convicted on 45 counts of child sexual abuse. And he was sentenced to a minimum of 30 years in prison. Because of this scandal, the NCAA imposed sanctions on the Penn State football program, including vacating all victories from 1998 through 2011. Now, those victories have since been reinstated, but the aftermath of that scandal was absolutely brutal as a Penn State alumnus. What I found the hardest thing to understand was how many people seemed to be somewhat clued in that something was very wrong. There were failures all over the place, failures that allowed a pedophile to continue to have access to victims. I struggled to understand how people, several people, could witness these crimes, and yet their testimonies either not happen or somehow get lost in the chain of command. Now, this is an extreme example, but something like this happens on a small scale practically every day. When we witness something concerning and we choose not to say anything about it. Think about a child's behavior that is absolutely atrocious, and the parents don't even seem to notice, and no one says anything. Or what about a toxic work environment? How many times have you done this? Not said something when you probably should have? I know I have. Our best chance of actually taking full and appropriate action against something that we find concerning is right when it first happens. If we don't capitalize on that time, we are likely to get busy, start making excuses. The next time we see it, we'll be a little less sensitized to it, and eventually we will just view it as normal. We get why this happens. Confrontation is difficult. What merits a confrontation? Who should do it? How can it be done in an effective way? This week's text gives us a very good picture of effective confrontation. And so it's going to provide many lessons to believers today. The book of Joshua is drawing to a close. Last week, Joshua finished dividing up the land amongst the tribes, and he established the cities of refuge. He gave cities to the Levites. Now, the work wasn't complete. Each of the tribes were going to have to continue to drive the Canaanites out of their land. But as this week's passage opens, it seems that Joshua is now in a position where he is able to disband the unified army. So let's start reading in Joshua 22, starting in verse 1. Joshua summoned the Reubenites, Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh and told them, "You have done everything Moses, the Lord's servant, commanded you, and you have obeyed me in everything I commanded you. You have not deserted your brothers even once this whole time, but have carried out the requirement of the command of the Lord your God. Now that he has given your brothers rest, just as he promised them, return to your homes in your own land that Moses, the Lord's servant, gave you across the Jordan." So Joshua summons the 2.5 tribes so that he can send them back to their inheritance. As a reminder, the Israelites, as they approached the Promised Land towards the end of the book of Numbers, these tribes had requested land outside of the Promised Land. And they made the following commitment: "We will not return to our homes until each of the Israelites has taken possession of his inheritance. And Moses allowed it with the following condition. If you do this, if you arm yourselves for battle before the Lord, and every one of your armed men crosses the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven his enemies from his presence and the land is subdued before the Lord, afterward, you may return and be free from obligation to the Lord and to Israel. And this land will belong to you as a possession before the Lord. Then when the book of Joshua opened, Joshua reminded these tribes of what they had committed to, and they reaffirmed their commitment directly to Joshua. They said, "Everything you have commanded us to do, we will do. Everywhere you send us, we will go. We will obey you just as we obeyed Moses in everything." The eastern tribes had done everything that they said that they would do. And now that the land was subdued, Joshua was fulfilling Moses' commitment to them that they could return to their inheritance. I really don't think it can be overemphasized how big of a deal it was what these eastern tribes did. For it's exemplary for a group this large. We are talking probably 100,000 troops would keep a commitment for this long. It was a minimum of 7 years, but it was likely decades. And as they were sent home with a great deal of plunder, which was basically their fair share for all the work that they had done to help the Israelites subdue the promised land. And Joshua also exhorts them, verse 5, "Only carefully obey the command and instruction that Moses, the Lord's servant, gave you to love the Lord your God, walk in all his ways, keep his commands, be loyal to him, and serve him with all your heart and all your soul." So the eastern tribes start traveling back, and they get to the point where they're about to cross back over the Jordan, and they stop, and they build a very large and impressive altar. Why? This never really made any sense to me until I pictured myself as a member of the eastern tribes, coming back to where it had all begun. I'm sure this brought back so many memories for them, like Jericho, the day the sun stood still, the northern and the southern campaigns, everything God had done and everything that they had been through. Don't you imagine that crossing back over brought with it some mixed emotions? Like when you finally achieve something, but then you realize that you're coming to the end of an era and that your life is never going to be the same again. When you graduate from high school or college or you change jobs, you might be happy about these things, but at the same time, maybe just a little bit sad. Perhaps the Eastern tribes felt these emotions. Or who knows whatever thoughts they had. They could have maybe been second-guessing their request for land outside the promised land. Like, did we do the right thing? From their response when they were confronted, we know that at a minimum, they were a little bit worried. Worried that as time passed, they would not be considered as part of Israel. And this was a legitimate concern. Out of sight, out of mind. But although it was a legitimate concern, if they were faithful to do what God said, if they were to travel to Shiloh 3 times a year for each of the festivals, they would have minimized the chances of this happening. If they were like, "Hey guys, see you in 3 months," and they were faithful to always do that, always show up, that probably wouldn't have happened. From their response, we also see that they were worried about their children eventually not worshiping the Lord. This too is a legitimate concern. Many of us with children have this same concern. But again, if they were faithful to follow the commands of the Lord, the chances of this happening would be minimized. If they brought their families 3 times a year to Shiloh, if they talked to their kids about the Lord and all the things he had done, this probably wouldn't have happened. God gives us so many commands in order to help us avoid bad things happening. So our obedience is really key. So because of these concerns, they build this replica altar. It's a replica of the altar that was at Shiloh. What the eastern tribes did probably seemed pretty strange to you, but it's not actually that strange when you look at other parts of the Bible. For example, in Genesis, often people would build altars at memorable places, And it actually looks a little bit like an extension of what they did when they crossed into the Promised Land, when they set up all those stones in Gilgal. This time they set up a replica altar. Let's pick back up reading in verse 11. Then the Israelites heard it said, "Look, the Reubenites, Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, at the region of the Jordan, on the Israelite side." When the Israelites heard this, the entire Israelite community assembled at Shiloh to go to war against them. When the Western tribes heard about the altar, they jumped to a conclusion. They assumed that the Eastern tribes had constructed this altar in order to turn away from the Lord. We know that this was their assumption because in their confrontation, they referenced the iniquity of Peor. This occurrence happened, and it's documented in Numbers chapter 25. While the Israelites were camped at the Acacia Grove, before they crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, they were invited by the Moabites to their feasts. And they went, and they ate, and they worshiped their gods. What they had done at Peor was very serious. They broke one of the Ten Commandments, the first commandment: do not worship any god except me. Worshiping another god under God's law was a crime punishable by death. In the case of Peor, it resulted in a plague that killed 24,000 Israelites. So by referencing Peor, we see that the Western tribes assumed that the Eastern tribes were planning on abandoning worship to God, worshiping a different god. Now, I want to point out that it was not outside of the realm of possibility that the tribes might do this, that they might worship another god. They had already done it at Peor, and they would do it many more times in the future. It actually turns out that it is pretty easy to enter into idolatry. And if they had started to worship another god, this would have been very serious. It would have merited a confrontation. So the Western tribes assemble, and they assemble in order to go to war against the Eastern tribes. Now, this may seem a bit extreme, but we saw in our homework that they actually followed the exact process that God had laid out. They prepare to go to war, but first, they fully investigate the charges by confronting the Eastern tribes. Let's notice some things about this confrontation. First, they reacted right away. Also, they laid out what they thought had been done. They warned them about the consequences. And hopefully you saw that they try to be part of the solution. As they were trying to figure out why the Eastern tribes might do something like this, they guessed that having returned to their land, maybe they have decided that they think it's defiled. So they offer them the option of coming back. This was a very big offer. Essentially, they were offering to give up about a third of their land in order to make space in the Promised Land for these tribes. This was a costly offer. Let's look at how the Eastern tribes responded. I'll start reading in verse 21. The Reubenites, Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh answered the heads of the Israelite clans, "The mighty one, God, the Lord. The mighty one, God, the Lord. He knows, and may Israel also know. Do not spare us today. If it was in rebellion or treachery against the Lord that we have built for ourselves an altar to turn away from him, may the Lord himself hold us accountable if we intended to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings on it or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it." And they go on to explain that they actually made the altar to be a witness between the Eastern and the Western tribes. And they conclude by saying, verse 29, "We would never, ever rebel against the Lord or turn away from him today by building an altar for burnt offering, grain offering, or sacrifice, other than the altar of the Lord our God, which is in front of his tabernacle." The Eastern tribes assure the Western tribes that they have no intention of abandoning worship of God. And they also take it a step further, and they assert that they have no intention of offering sacrifices to God on this altar either. And I think that sort of begs the question, would it have been so bad if they had intended to offer sacrifices to God on this altar? God made it abundantly clear that the Israelites were not to do this. "You must offer your burnt offerings only in the place the Lord chooses in one of your tribes." all sacrifices had to be offered at the tabernacle on the altar. When we studied in the book of Numbers, we saw that God was specific about when sacrifices had to be offered. Every morning, every evening, every Sabbath, the beginning of every month, and during those seven appointed times that God commanded. Just like he was specific about when to offer sacrifices, God was also specific about where to offer sacrifices. They had to be offered at the tabernacle on the altar. The eastern tribes demonstrate that they knew this. Now, I want to point out that just like it was not outside of the realm of possibility that God's people might worship another god, it also was not outside the realm of possibility that God's people might try to offer sacrifices at a place that God did not sanction. This too would be done in the future, but not just by the eastern tribes. All the tribes would eventually, after the time of the judges, be united into one kingdom under their first king, King Saul. And they would remain united under King David and then King Solomon. But after King Solomon's death, the kingdom was divided into two parts. The northern kingdom, which is referred to as Israel, and the southern kingdom, which is referred to as Judah. The very first king of the northern kingdom, King Jeroboam, decided that he did not want his people traveling to the place that God had selected because it was in the territory of the southern kingdom. He didn't want his people traveling down there because he feared that they would reunite with the other kingdom. And so he established other places for sacrifices. He established places in Bethel and in Dan. And he made golden calves to be visual representations of God to the people. And then he set up his own priesthood out of the ranks of the normal people, not Levites. His people likely believed that they were worshiping God, but they weren't worshiping him in the place he had selected. And they broke several other laws about how to worship God to the point where it didn't even look at all like what God commanded. What was perhaps an outrage to one generation just became a normal thing as the years went on, with each subsequent king continuing on in the same sin. The Bible comments on this over and over again. Look, Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel. Nadab did what was evil in the Lord's sight and walked in the ways of his father and the sin he had caused Israel to commit. Then Baasha walked in the ways of Jeroboam and the sin he had caused Israel to commit. Then Omri walked in all the ways of Jeroboam in every respect and continued in his sins that he caused Israel to commit. And it got worse and worse. And the people then started worshiping other gods. But even when we get to probably the best king of the northern kingdom, King Jehu. Jehu eliminated Baal worship from Israel, but he did not turn away from the sins that Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit, worshiping the golden calves that were in Bethel and Dan. And it continued. Jehoahaz followed the sins of Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. He did not turn away from them. Jehoash did not turn away from the sins that Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit, but he continued them. A different Jeroboam did not turn away from the sins Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. Zechariah did not turn away from the sins Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. Menahem did not turn away from the sins Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. Pekahiah did not turn away from the sins Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. Until finally, the northern kingdom was exiled, because the Israelites persisted in all the sins that Jeroboam committed and did not turn away from them. Finally, the Lord removed Israel from his presence, just as he had declared through all his servants, the prophets. So Israel has been exiled to Assyria from their homeland to this very day. God is specific about proper worship for good reason. Obviously, it's worse for God's people to abandon God altogether or to worship other gods in addition to God. But what happened in the northern kingdom shows us that there is a very slippery slope. We'll just move the place of worship a little bit, make it a little bit more convenient. Oh, and then maybe we'll add this here and that here. And all of a sudden, it doesn't look at all like what God commanded. So the Western tribes confronting the Eastern tribes right away was a very good thing. If they hadn't, perhaps they would have started to offer sacrifices to God on this altar, and perhaps they would have followed in the path of the Northern Kingdom. This confrontation is perhaps what kept the Eastern tribes from going down a very slippery slope. Let's pick back up reading in verse 30. When the priest Phinehas and the community leaders, the heads of Israel's clans who were with him, heard what the descendants of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh had to say, they were pleased. Verse 32. Then the priest Phinehas, son of Eleazar, and the leaders returned from the Reubenites and Gadites in the land of Gilead to the Israelites in the land of Canaan and brought back a report to them. The Israelites were pleased with the report, and they blessed God. They spoke no more about going to war against them to ravage the land where the Reubenites and Gadites lived. So the Reubenites and Gadites named the altar, "It is a witness between us that the Lord is God." This passage wraps up with a potential crisis averted, and who knows what other future problems were avoided. As we wrap up today, let's address those questions that I posed at the beginning. What merits a confrontation? Who should do it? And how can we do it in an effective way? So let's first consider what merits a confrontation. In this week's passage, we saw that some of God's people confronted others of God's people about something that was very important. So at a minimum, God's people should confront each other about very important things. It may seem strange that God required the Israelites to offer sacrifices to God at one place, but I believe that that was meant to show us that we must approach God the way that he says. There is only one way to approach God. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." We cannot come to God however we want. In order to approach God, the Israelites had to offer the required sacrifices at the required place. When we studied in Exodus, we saw that the tabernacle teaches about access to God. The tabernacle itself points to the person of Jesus Christ, how we access God. And in the book of Hebrews, we are told that Jesus' sacrifice is what makes us right with him, with God. The sacrifices point to the work of Jesus Christ. God having his people come to a specific place with specific sacrifices shows us that our one way to approach God is through his son, Jesus Christ. When we think about what merits a confrontation, we often get this wrong. We have a tendency to confront people about things that we probably shouldn't, and to not confront people about things that we absolutely should. We tend to want to confront people about things that are important to us, maybe, but if we honestly look at the Word of God, they are either unclear or they don't seem to be that important. This week's passage shows us what the most important thing is, that God's people worship God alone. If you suspect that a fellow believer, especially one that you are close to, is starting to abandon God or starting to worship other gods in addition to God, this is absolutely something that merits a confrontation, like the Western tribes did. The more important the issue, the more important it is that a confrontation take place. But even less important issues could merit a confrontation in order to avoid bigger issues. The next question is, who should confront someone? People are most likely to consider and respond favorably to confrontation that comes from someone who they know has their best interest at heart. Again, this is an area where we often get it wrong. We often want to confront people that maybe we shouldn't, and to not confront people that we absolutely should. We tend to want to confront people that we don't know well or that we do not have that good of a relationship with. And this often goes pretty badly, doesn't it? They often disregard it because they question our motives. And it can further damage a relationship that's already tense. In those cases, we actually might be better off by praying for this person and that someone would confront them that actually has the ability to speak into their life. So we have this tendency to confront people that maybe we shouldn't. And then conversely, we often avoid confronting people that we absolutely should, the ones that are near and dear to us, that we have great relationships with. If you are in a position where you can confront someone effectively, whether it's a huge issue or not, you should consider doing so. The more influence you have, the better the relationship you have with them, the more the chances are it is that you should be the one that should confront them. And if you have a great relationship with someone, then you don't really have to worry about how well you do this confrontation. It's probably going to go okay. But even if you don't know someone well, and even if you maybe have a strained relationship, that doesn't mean you shouldn't confront them. That just means that you need to be much more careful in how you do so. And that brings us to our final question. How can we confront someone in an effective way? There are many great resources available for this. One of my favorite books is one called Crucial Conversations. It is wonderful. It has guidance and practical help for doing things like this. But our best guidance always comes directly from the Bible. And it's actually pretty simple. Ephesians 4:15, but speaking the truth in love, let us grow in every way into him who is the head, Christ. Our goal in any confrontation should be the growth and the well-being of the person that we are confronting. In our confrontation, we should aim to speak the truth in the most loving way possible. Missing either part of this is not pleasing to God, and it's likely not going to be effective. If we're not going to speak the truth, why speak at all? It's probably not going to be helpful. It could actually be harmful. And if we're not going to speak from a place of love, with compassion and gentleness, we also might as well not speak at all. They probably won't even listen. This week's passage shows us components of a good confrontation. The Western tribes acted immediately when they heard about something suspicious. They didn't put it off. That might have resulted in them not having the confrontation. They attempted to speak the truth. But notice, what they thought was the truth was actually not the truth. They had jumped to a conclusion which happened to be wrong. Now, they did ask a question and they slowed down enough to allow some dialogue and the truth came out, but their initial reaction was not right. They showed genuine love for the other tribe when they offered to be part of the solution, to give up something to help them. And for their part, the eastern tribes were humble. They listened, they were not easily offended, they responded, and the response was good. As you're considering confronting others, you can put these principles into practice. Act immediately, as close to when you observe the concerning behavior as possible. Before confronting, stop. Remember, what you think is the truth might not actually be the truth. Consider why they might be doing what they're doing, or how might I be misinterpreting what it is that I'm looking at? When you confront others, you want to do so humbly and compassionately. State as objectively as possible what you have witnessed and why you find it concerning, and then invite some dialogue. Hey, can I talk to you? I might be totally off here, but I'm concerned. Am I wrong? I began today with some examples of all the bad things that can happen when we avoid confrontations. And this week's passage showed us all the good things that can happen from effective confrontation. So I want to encourage you to take this to heart in your own life, in the confrontations that you have. I'll conclude today with this quote that I love from Adam Grant. Communicating well is being direct in your message and kind in your delivery. The goal isn't to sugarcoat the truth. It's to make it clear that you're trying to help.